Good evening, everybody. We are going to be starting a new class tonight on the Book of Ecclesiastes, and we're going to be talking about that. Stephen, I'm going to be working off my tablet for this, and I can't see the Facebook chat while I'm working on it. So if someone makes a comment or a question, please interrupt me, and we'll address it, okay? All right. So, the Book of Ecclesiastes. So what is the Book of Ecclesiastes? Well, it's one of those that's way back in the Old Testament that a lot of you probably have never read. And it's like some of the books that, you know, people have heard about maybe, but we don't spend a lot of time back there. And it's really a shame because there's a lot of great stuff in the Book of Ecclesiastes. But Ecclesiastes is one of three books in the Bible that are generally believed to be written by Solomon. Proverbs is the one that everybody remembers, beginning all the Proverbs of wisdom. There's the Song of Solomon, which, of course, says it was written by Solomon. And then you have Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a very serious, thoughtful kind of book. And it's really a collection of Solomon's understanding about the nature of life and what's it all about and why does it matter. Or does it matter? And so it's really a very studious book. You know, a lot of books of the Bible, you can just kind of pick up and read a chapter or read a few verses, and, you know, you'll get a lot out of it. But you can kind of do that. And then you can do some of that in Ecclesiastes as well, but it's really something that you want to read through, and you want to really get the whole picture of what's being said, because if you take some of these things out of context, it can be quite confusing. In fact, it can even seem to contradict other things that we believe. That's why it's always important to keep things in context. And so we're going to be doing that here as we study the book. The name of the book itself, we might think we recognize because the word Ecclesiastes in Greek sounds a lot like the word ecclesiastical, or which is a word that we use in English, which basically means having to do with the priests or the church or something like that. We don't use those in the churches of Christ. It's really not a phrase we use that way. But the other thing you might recognize, exactly. Good point. Next point. You might hear that word ecclesia is in there, and in fact, that word has a similar base as ecclesia, but it means something slightly different. It does have to do with the assembly. We know that the word ecclesia in Greek that we use for that is often translated church means the called out or the assembly. And well, Ecclesiastes means one who speaks in the assembly. It's a Hebrew word, koholos, and that was translated in the Septuagint to Ecclesiastes. And the English word preacher is probably the closest word that we have in English to the actual meaning of the term. It's somebody who speaks before the assembly. So it would be a preacher, or a teacher, a leader of some kind that speaks. And so when the book is basically called, if you wanted to translate it that way, the book is called The Preacher. And during this, there's a lot of preaching. Not preaching like we would, you know, typically think of, but, you know, in modern day sermons. But there's a reasoning that's going on. There's a logical presentation of evidence and thinking and reasoning and questions and conclusions. One of the commentaries I read on this said that the Book of Ecclesiastes is almost like it's written out like it's an academic research paper. It sets out its premise, it goes and gathers evidence, it compares and contrasts the evidence and looks at all of it and tries to find meaning in it, and then comes out with a conclusion. It's a very organized kind of presentation. And so, you know, you can start in it, and there's a lot of famous quotes and things that you'll hear that came from the Book of Ecclesiastes. Like you may have heard, there's nothing new under the sun. Well, that's actually in the first chapter of Ecclesiastes. You may have heard, I remember when I was a kid in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a song that said, for everything, turn, 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 there is a season, turn, 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 right? And a time for every purpose under heaven. That's in Ecclesiastes as well. There's a whole chapter that basically has all of that, a time to live, a time to die, a time to all these different things. And so it's not like it's an unknown book, but most of the detail of the book is really not talked about and taught a lot. And one of the things that's important in understanding the book of Ecclesiastes is to understand its writer and where this person is in their life. Because the book says, I went and did these things, and this is what I learned. I mean, that's kind of the phrase that you'll hear all through it. There's a lot of writing in the first person here. And so we ask ourselves the question, who's the author and when was it written? It's a good thing to start in any kind of study of the Bible. You might all say, well, hold it. You just said it's Solomon. I mean, it's Ecclesiastes. It's written by Solomon. But that's not generally agreed. It is by most Judeo-Christian scholars for probably on the order of maybe 1,500 years. But just like almost everything biblical these days, if you go to Wikipedia, and I did this the other day, I went to Wikipedia and I read the Wikipedia article on Ecclesiastes. And so I'm going to see what they say. So it says, in fact, it says, for many hundreds of years, the schools of thought in Christianity and Judaism have believed commonly that Solomon wrote it, but now modern scholars really don't think so. It doesn't give any evidence. It doesn't give any reason why. It's just like, oh yeah, we don't need any of that old Bible stuff anymore. We know better. And you know, we see that so much now. I mean, we did that when we studied Isaiah years ago. People say, oh, it's got to be three different people at least. It couldn't have been the same person. You know, there's all this stuff about, they say, oh, Daniel can't really be real, you know, because it's talking about prophecies about things that didn't happen for 400 years, and we know nobody can really do that. You know, there's just an extreme lack of faith in these people who claim to be biblical scholars. They don't believe in inspiration. They don't, half the time, they don't even believe in God. And yet they're passing judgment on the Word of God, which is pretty ridiculous. But let's just look at this and see. So, there's, you know, folks have different theories about authorship and things, but one of the things that you have to do when you look at a book in the Bible, in fact, look at lots of other books too, is see what the book says about itself. You know, it's its own testimony in a sense. The author of Ecclesiastes, and you'll see this in verse, really the very first verse. In fact, we'll go take a look at it here. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Okay, and then he starts into his treatise, which we'll start in here in a minute. And then down in verse 12, he says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Okay, so who is this preacher? He's the king in Jerusalem over Israel, and he calls himself the son of David. Now, some of that should be pretty obvious. How many kings of Israel were there? In fact, it's very important to notice that he says he was king over Israel in Jerusalem. But let's start with son of David. Now, you would say, what does it mean to be a son of David? Well, you'd say, well, he was a son of David. David was his father. Okay, that's kind of the obvious case, but isn't Christ a son of David? Isn't that one of the things you remember when he came in on the triumphal entry in Jerusalem the week before he was crucified? They said, you know, it said, praise to the son of David. Well, he wasn't the actual son of David in the sense of if David was his father. But when this phrase is used, it means a descendant of. So he was the son of David. He was a great, 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 great grandson. And so it's possible that if just as said, I was a son of David, that could mean any of David's descendants, because any of them could say that I'm a son of David. But this king over Israel and Jerusalem is a really key point. First of all, he says he was king in Jerusalem. So he was reigning as a king. So we have a list of all the kings. We know who all the kings were who reigned in Jerusalem, right? We studied that in the chronologies. It's all in the Bible. You can look it up. So there's only so many of them. And of course, there was the united kingdom under Saul and David and Solomon. And then there was the divided kingdom where Judah and Benjamin stayed around Jerusalem. and formed the nation of Judah and the kingdom of Judah, and the rest of the tribes in northern Israel formed the nation of Israel. After that point, they were called Israel. So the fact that he says, I was king over Israel in Jerusalem, is also really important, because he doesn't say I was king over Judah in Jerusalem, because that would have been clear that it was after the divided kingdom. But it wasn't, because he says, I was king over Israel, over all of Israel, and I was in Jerusalem. So really, the only person that this could be, you know, has to be Solomon, because the son of David, David can't be his own son, so David wouldn't be a son of David. And Rehoboam, who was Solomon's son, who was also a son of David in that sense, and was king in Jerusalem, was not king over Israel, because the northern kingdom split away. So it's really pretty clear. If you just look at this, look at the evidence, look at the rest of the Bible, there's other claims that are made in the book. In 1:16, it says that he had great wisdom, more than anyone before him in Jerusalem. And then a little later, it says he had great wealth, more than anyone before him. And in another section of Ecclesiastes, it says, I built great buildings. I had all kinds of great constructions all over the place. So you have to put all this evidence together and say, okay, who wrote the book? He was a descendant of David. He was king over Israel and Jerusalem. He had greater wisdom than any king before him, anyone before him. That fits Solomon. He had great wealth, more than any before. That fits Solomon. And he was a great builder. That fits Solomon too. And in fact, all these things aren't just stated in Ecclesiastes. These are all applied to Solomon in Kings, where in 1 Kings, where Solomon is described in reign. So, okay, it's Solomon. No one else really fits. And in fact, it wouldn't make a lot of sense if it wasn't Solomon, because of some of the things that are said about how he goes about his life and how he goes about seeking out wisdom in this situation. But we need to understand a little bit who Solomon is. So, okay, who's Solomon? Solomon was one of David's sons. He was a son of Bathsheba. He was not the first son of David. He had other ones. Of course, there was Absalom, and they went through the whole problem with the civil war around Absalom trying to become king. We know that David had had a child by Bathsheba when she was still married. And to Uriah the Hittite, who was one of David's soldiers, and that whole situation where David caused him to be killed and everything, and all the sin that went on there. And that child died. And after that, though, Solomon was born. And it says that the Lord loved Solomon. And in fact, great Bible bowl question. What was Solomon's other name? Stephen probably knows this one. Yeah. Yep, there you go. So that's a great Bible bowl question, because no one ever knows it. It's only written down, I think, in one place. But Solomon, from his youth, was favored by God. So let's just read a little bit about Solomon once he becomes king. So David declares Solomon king. David dies. There's a period of time where Solomon is consolidating his kingship, basically by getting rid of the enemies in the land. And so in 1 Kings chapter 3, we're going to read a little bit about Solomon when right after he first became king, and after he had established his authority in the kingdom. Now Solomon made a treaty with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and married Pharaoh's daughter. Then he brought her to the city of David until he had finished his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around all Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the people sacrificed at the high places, because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. And Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Now the king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for there was a great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, "Ask, what shall I give you?" And Solomon said, "You have shown great mercy to your servant, David, my father, because he walked before you in truth and righteousness and in uprightness of heart with you. You have continued this great kindness for him, and you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too numerous to be numbered or counted. Therefore, give to your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge? The speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. And I have also given you what you had not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be anyone like you among the kings of all your days. So if you walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. Then Solomon woke, and indeed it had been a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the ark of the covenant of the Lord and offered up burnt offerings, peace offerings, and made a feast for all of his servants. So that sounds really great. Sounds like Solomon's a pretty great guy. And in those days he was. He started out as a very, you know, very focused on doing right by God. He had listened to his father David. We know David spent a lot of time teaching his children, trying to teach them about the wisdom of God. And so, you know, you think, here's Solomon, he's king, and God says, Solomon, ask, what do you want? I'll give you whatever you want. And Solomon just asked for wisdom, and God gives him wisdom, and he says, because you haven't asked for all the other things people would normally ask for, like a long life or riches or safety from your enemies, he says, I'm going to give you all that too. So God really piled it on to Solomon, just blessings on blessings. Now, one of the things you might have heard in there was verse 7. Now, O Lord my God, since you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I am a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. Okay, first of all, he's speaking poetically here. This is hyperbole. He's not a little child. He's already married Pharaoh's daughter, okay, and he's king. So he's not a little child. But what he's saying basically is how do I have the wisdom to govern these people? I'm just like a little child in that sense. I need your wisdom. And he prays for God's wisdom, and God gives him wisdom. But this all sounds great, and it is great. And in fact, if you read a lot of Solomon's writings and Proverbs, you see just this constant focus on the value of wisdom, the wisdom of God, and seeking understanding and seeking wisdom. And you think, that sounds like a pretty good guy. So let's look at the end of the story, of Solomon's story. So this is 1 Kings chapter 11. It's not completely the end. It's not his death, but it's kind of the section that really says kind of what happened 40 years later, because he was king for 40 years. Verse 1, but Solomon loved many foreign women, as well as the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabs, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it was so when Solomon was old that his wives turned his heart after their gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, on the hill that is east of Jerusalem, and for Molech, the abomination of the people of Ammon. And he did likewise for all of his foreign wives, who burned incense and sacrificed to their gods. So the Lord became angry with Solomon, because his heart had turned from the Lord God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice, and had commanded him concerning this thing, that he should not go after other gods. But he did not keep what the Lord had commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this and have not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." Wow. So that's a huge difference, 40 years. In the beginning, he was a young man. He was focused and dedicated to the Lord. All he wanted was wisdom so he could govern his people and please God. In his old age, he let his love of women and wives turn him away from God. And it says that he even built idols' temples all over Jerusalem and sacrificed there. You can't imagine. I mean, this is somebody who God has appeared to. He says, "So I appeared to him twice, and yet it turned his heart." So there's a couple of things we know about this. So first of all, Solomon was a wise man, but he was not omniscient. And he didn't know everything. God said he was going to give him wisdom. He said, and he even says in Ecclesiastes, "I was one of the wisest men that ever lived." But he wasn't omniscient. He didn't know everything. And he was still very much a man with all the temptations that a man has. So, you know, when we think about what we're going to read in Ecclesiastes, we're going to see echoes of this kind of stuff, of his life. One of the things that people ask is, you know, when is the book written? And, of course, if Solomon is the writer, and I think that's pretty much the only real possibility there, that it was written then in the period of time probably between around 970 and 930 B.C. It was written toward the end of, it was written during Solomon's reign. He reigned for 40 years. But in general, people think that the Song of Solomon was written early in Solomon's life, when he was a younger man, a younger king, and in particular about one of his wives. That Proverbs was written during his life. It was a collection of sayings and wisdom that was collected during his life, and that Ecclesiastes was written later in life. And there's another hint in the book of Ecclesiastes that we'll get to eventually. It's further into the book, but it says something about better to be a wise child than to be a foolish old king who will not accept instruction anymore. And he may not be talking about himself, but he might be as well. So my best guess here is that Solomon is writing this at the end of his life. He's looking back at everything he's done, and he's realized what matters and what doesn't. And that's really the theme of the book. The question actually happens in the very first, verse 3. He sets out the question that the whole book is trying to answer. He says, "What profit has a man for all of his labor, which he labors under the sun?" You know, basically, in modern English, we might say, what's life all about? What's worthwhile? What matters? Why does it matter? Why should anything matter? You know, these are big questions. These are the kinds of questions that people ask. Sometimes when some children start asking it, you know, about the time they get into junior high and into high school, for sure, and they start saying, man, what's life all about? What is this whole thing about? And a lot of us ask those questions throughout our whole lives. Sometimes people, when they get to their middle of their age, they have what's called a midlife crisis. And one of the common things about a midlife crisis is people are saying, what's life about? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? You know, and they may be 40 or 50 or 60 years old when that's going on. And so these are big questions. These are not easily answered in the sense that anyone can just kind of find it out for themselves. So we're going to go ahead and read the first chapter here, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away, and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises, and the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes toward the south, and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually, and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be, and with that which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it may be said, see, this is new? It has already been in ancient times before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who come after. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be numbered. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this is also the grasping for the wind, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So, if you're not already a little depressed by reading these words, you ought to go back and read them again. Think about the writer who's writing this, how he's feeling. Do you hear it? The very first thing he says after introducing himself, vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. In other translations, they'll use the word meaningless. Meaningless. Everything is meaningless. You know, the word there that's actually used can mean vanity or meaningless or worthless or absurdity or frustration or nonsense. You know, he's basically saying, what matters? I can't find anything that matters. Everything is empty. Everything is worthless. Nothing matters. Man, that's a dark way to start a book. You know, you'd think, this is Solomon. He's been blessed by God. He's actually had God appear to him twice. He's lived his life full of the blessings of God, and yet he says nothing matters. Wow. So first of all, it's really important to not take these things out of context. This book really needs to be taken all together. And, you know, if you take any one of these things, you'd say, well, hold it, that's not right. Like, for instance, it says, well, let's just do the thing here, verses 9 and 10. That which has been is what will be, and that which is done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which may be said, see, this is new? It was already been in ancient times before us. So we'd sit there and go, hold on a second. Stephen just prayed and thanked God for the technology that's allowing us to meet. I'm sitting here looking at an iPad, reading these notes, and I'm talking over an iPhone. I had two other people conferenced in on it. We're broadcasting to the internet. We're going up on Facebook. Anyone on the entire planet could be watching and listening to this right now. Isn't that new? Well, see, this is the important thing about keeping this in the context of the book. He's not talking about inventions, and he's not talking about technology. What he's talking about is life. He says, life hasn't changed. Life, death, work, rest, joy, sorrow, birth, death, those things are always there. And even discoveries. Do you think there was nothing discovered during the time of Solomon? You know, in his 60, 70 years that he lived, that there was never somebody said, hey, there's something new? Well, of course there was. If nothing else, there were traders that were taking goods from all over the area and caravans coming through, and there'd be some widget or something or some new chariot or some sort of design, some new kind of sword. You know, who knows what it was that somebody had invented, and they would have said, well, here's something new. So, you know, some people will say, an unbeliever will look at this and he says, there's nothing new under the sun. It's all been here before. And they say, ha, you see, this isn't inspired. Don't they know about iPhones? That's not what he's talking about at all. What he's talking about is absolutely true. That life and death and work and rest and joy and sorrow and birth and death all have been going on as long as there have been life on the earth. And they will go on a long time after we're gone. What he's focused on is that verse up here in verse 3. What profit has a man from all of his labor which he toils under the sun? What's the meaning of life? What's the purpose of life?
Another point we can get from that is is that the nature of man hasn't changed. You look at, it's very similar to what we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 verse 13, looking at that whole concept of the examples of the Old Testament and things of that nature to look at how best that we can attack sin, and looking at the tools that the devil uses to try to ensnare us. And we have, and it's no different for us today. While the technology might be different, the temptations are the same. The motivations are the same. So we're no different as a species, though the means may be different.
And in fact, you know, you can go all the way back to the Garden of Eden, because it says that, you know, Eve, what was Eve's temptation, right? When she saw that the fruit was good for food, and that it was pleasing to the eye, and it was desired to make one wise, and what do you have? You have the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. You have all the same temptations that every man and woman have ever had. And that's all the same. And life is still the same. And this is really framing what the rest of the book talks a lot about. He goes on to try to find out, where's the meaning of life? And, you know, he starts out here, he talks about all the things that don't change. He says in verse 4, one generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. You know, there are people that take that and says, hold it. You know, Peter, we just read it in Peter and Thessalonians in our last study. It says the earth's going to be burned up. Here it says the earth abides forever. You see, it's a contradiction. He's not talking about the physical planet. What he's talking about is life keeps going on. Generations come and generations go. You know, the sun also rises and the sun goes down. It hastens back to the place where it arose. The wind goes to the south. It turns to the north. It whirls around continually. All the rivers run into the sea. The sea's not full, but the place to the rivers come, they go back again. Do you see this whole notion of cycles of cycles of cycles? Things repeating over and over and over. That the patterns of life and the patterns of the earth are things that just keep going and keep going and keep going. And so he's sitting there going like, okay, so there's this big wheel that keeps turning around and around and around. So what's the purpose of it all? What's the reason for it all? And he takes his God-given wisdom. Remember, this is the guy that God said, I'm going to give you wisdom and understanding. He's taking his great wisdom and understanding, and he is going to search for the answer to those questions. And he's going to document his search in the book of Ecclesiastes. When he says something in verse 11, that's an interesting foreshadowing as well. He says, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who come after. Well, I said, well, that's kind of silly. We're sitting here reading his words, right? He's lived several thousand years ago. We're reading his words. Do we remember his former things? Do we remember Solomon's life? Yeah, we have the Bible to show us. That's not what he's talking about. Again, you're going to hear me say this a lot, because lots of people will take these verses out of context and try to pit the Bible against the Bible, which is about as silly as it gets. Notice what he says. People don't remember what I do in my life. The next generation isn't going to remember. The next generation after that is not going to remember them. And it's just going to go on and on and on that way. Now, he's not talking about a historical event, but we've seen it in our own lives. So my mother and my father were both young teenagers when World War II happened, okay? I was born in 1958, so I was born after World War II and really the beginning of the Cold War. My daughter was born in 1983, and now my grandson was born 5 years ago, right? And generations, we don't even understand. We talk about, you know, the millennials and the Gen Xers and the Gen Zs and whatever the next gen is, we don't know. And they have very different experiences. You know, when I grew up, everybody that I knew, my uncles and aunts, had all been alive during World War II. Many of my uncles fought in World War II. Many of my relatives died in World War II. And so it was a present reality to them. But for my daughter, that was old history. That was grandpa and great-grandpa. And for my grandson, it's really ancient history. It might as well be back in Solomon's time. And this is a lot of what he's talking about here, is there's so much of our lives that those who come after us aren't going to know about. I don't know if you've ever had the chance to have a close relative pass away, and you had to deal with their effects, with the things in their life. And you go over all the things that they'd collected and all the things they had in their closets and all the things they had in their boxes. And you realize that at least sometime in their life, they thought these things had some meaning to them. They had some importance to them. Now, be honest, if you've done this, what percentage of that stuff did you actually keep? It wasn't very much. You couldn't. And a lot of it had no meaning for you. It may have been very meaningful for them, but it had no meaning for you. That's what he's talking about, is this kind, you know, whatever happens, all the details, all the things that he's going to do in his life, the next generation will vaguely remember it. Two generations away, they won't even think about it anymore. They'll be focused on their own lives. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. Now he says, I have set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. He's set himself a big job. This reminds me so much of Proverbs chapter 2 that I want to go read part of that, because this is written by Solomon earlier in his life. And actually, Proverbs chapter 2 is a great place to be, a great place to study. We'll read the first part of it here. My son, if thou wilt receive... I'm sorry, this is King James. Let me switch over. Let me get out of King James. There we go. My son, if you receive my words and treasure my commands within you, so that you incline your ear to wisdom and apply your heart to understanding, yes, if you cry out for discernment and lift up your voice for understanding, if you seek her as silver and search for her as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. For the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield for those who walk uprightly. He guards the path of justice and preserves the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice, equity, and every good path. That goes on, but you can see the basic point. This is Solomon telling his children, my son, receive my words. He says, if you seek wisdom and you cry out for understanding and you seek it like hidden treasure, you will get it. You will find it. He says, we can know things. We can learn things. And if we seek it with all our heart, we can find the knowledge of God. This is a great comfort to people who wonder, you know, can I ever really understand what God wants me to do? Because there it says right there, if you seek it with all your heart, you can find it. Of course, we know we have God's word to teach us. But notice what he says. He says, I set my heart to seek and search out all that is done under heaven. He's looking at everything. And then he says, this is his, kind of his result, this burdensome task God has given to the sons of men. You're going to hear a lot about this burden. And how something is, and sometimes he calls it a great evil, a great misfortune, a grasping after the wind. You hear he's going to use vanity and grasping for the wind a lot. Have you ever tried to grab the wind? Now, if you're a sailor, you say, yeah, you put up a sail and you got it. Now, he's talking about with your hands. You can't grab the wind with your hands. It's just impossible. It's moving, it's doing what it's going to do, and you can't do anything with your hands to stop it. So he's saying that these things, everything, he says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping through the wind. He studied mankind and life. He studied the earth. When to learn about more of this, and we're going to stop here in a minute because this could go on all night. It's a fascinating book, but we'll save some for next time. That Solomon studied architecture, he studied agriculture, he studied biology, he studied all the technology of his day, he studied psychology, he studied love, he studied relationships, he studied everything that was available. And yet, what does he say? Where's the meaning of it all? So we'll keep that with us. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. You know, this again is some of his frustration. He's saying things are what they are, and there's only so much we can change. In verse 16, he says, I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness, and I've gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. They're the opposites of wisdom. I perceive that this also is a grasping for the wind. Even his exercise of trying to figure things out, he says, was futile and vain. Verse 18 kind of sums it up for tonight. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. For many of us who are older and wiser because we've lived many years, you know, it's not because we're better or smarter. It's because we've been through an awful lot. And what do you learn from that? There's so much wisdom here in verse 18. And much wisdom is much grief. That is the source of a lot of times of our wisdom. You know, we talk about learning hard lessons. Life is full of hard lessons. We're living a hard lesson right now with this whole virus thing. But life is full of hard lessons. And you can ignore them and suffer for it, or you can learn from them and become wise. But you know what? He who increases knowledge increases sorrow. But he's not just saying that learning makes you sad. What he's saying is you learn where things are headed. Have you ever, this is where I really miss being face to face with y'all, because I just love asking a question like this and seeing your faces, because I can see these knowing looks. Is to say, have you ever, any of my older brothers and sisters, have you ever known a young person and they're all excited about going off and doing something or trying something, and you know where it's going to end? You know it's a bad road. And you just say, oh, child, don't go down that road. You don't want to go do that. They go, oh, but it's going to be great, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and it's going to be excellent. It's a war. I can't wait. Boy, don't do that. I've been down that road. Don't go down that road. And of course, most of the time, they don't listen and they go down that road and they suffer for it. But how many of us who are older, your grandparents and parents, have seen that in our lives? You understand the meaning of this verse. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Okay, we'll stop there for the night. Stephen?